Good morning. Good morning. I'm Brian, and I'd like to welcome you to the Liminal Church, whether you're sitting here or somewhere in the universe. Good to see you. Glad to have you. I'm one of the members of the teaching team here. Today, we'll be continuing our series on the restoration of shalom, all right? To have shalom is to have a flourishing and abundant relationship, not lacking with anything, with nature. That's what we started with, lo, these many weeks ago, right? And then we moved on to with God, right? And then with each other. And today, I get to talk about the easy subject of dealing with ourselves. I mean, when you look at those other three topics, you think, oh, nature, sure, God, we got that. With each other, it gets a little more difficult, but dealing with ourselves, that can get tough, right? Today, we'll start our exploration of shalom as it applies to us individually. Peace with self, right? Peace within ourselves. So, question for you. How are you doing with you? All right? You're here, all right? And according to studies, being part of a faith community is, lo and behold, good for us, right? Seriously, being part of a group that emphasizes self-transformation as well as communion, really just sitting next to our fellow humans, provides us with good things, right? We get better health, and we actually, they say, according to the studies, we become more compassionate, probably because we're not sitting at home watching the television or reading the news. We are actually interacting with our fellow humans. Today I've entitled this short teaching, and it is pretty short, and for most of you that have been around church for a while, you're gonna go, okay, yeah, I've heard this before. And the thing about that is you're like, that's always that issue with like familiarity breeds contempt. It's like, yeah, I've heard this. And so I'll just put this right out here. I'm gonna get to the subject in a minute. If you are in any way contemptuous with what I'm about to approach, then this is probably for you, because, and you'll get it in a minute why I'm saying this, because you're going to say, oh yeah, I've heard this before, but the underlying question is, how are you doing dealing with it? So we'll just let that hang there for a second. So I've entitled this teaching today as Fall Fashion, right? Fall Fashion, which when you look at this next picture, you'll get an understanding as to why. We're also going to call it garden life. One of the things that struck me a few weeks ago was, while we were talking about this, that all of the teachings I've heard about the garden, right, they tend to, one, they blow right through pretty much chapter 1 and 2, and they get to the fall, because that's, you know, the meat of the story. But what I've loved about what the teaching team has been doing, and teachers that are far better than the short, bald-headed guy standing in front of you now, have focused on the beauty of life in the garden, right? The Garden of Eden. And that is really what we're trying to get back to, is that kind of relationship with God, with nature, with ourselves, and with each other. But I've heard a lot of teachings, and I think it might have been after Jenny said exegetical whateverness a couple of weeks ago, that I went, huh. And I was driving away with my wife, and I was telling her I thought that was really funny, and then I stopped and I said, you know, the odd thing is, in all of the teachings about the garden, I don't ever remember anybody focusing on the fact that Adam and Eve had no clothes. And my wife paused, as she often does when I bring up ideas like this, and then she said, please don't talk about that. So, here we are. Wow, who said that? Thank you very much, because honestly, wait. So knowing I was preparing for a future teaching, my wife paused briefly and said, please don't talk about that. But the next line, so here we are. And then I wrote, I'm sure somebody has talked about this, right? You know, the Beatles said, nothing you say, you know, by inference has not been said. But here we are. Why haven't I heard more about the fact in the biblical origin story that the first humans, right, the first two on the planet were running around naked like a couple of toddlers? In a sense, that's kind of what they were, right? The argument's made that the idea is that the tree of evil, good and evil, wasn't something that they, you know, were not going to eat. It's that they weren't really ready for it yet, which is an interesting idea, right? But, so that we have these two toddlers running around, right? So hold on to that question for just a moment while I make a Markan sandwich. And those of you that were with us for Mark, you know what that means, right? I'm going to take a story and I'm going to interrupt it with another story and then bring it back to the story, kind of ABA. Mark uses it a lot in his gospel, and people have said to me, Brian, that's how you talk, just in normal life. So here we are. So a clue for why we may never have heard a lot about the fact that Adam and Eve were naked may be found in a museum in the Vatican. This place is huge. It's ginormous. I've talked about this before, but I'm going to do it again just to emphasize the sheer size of this place. It's said that the Vatican Museums contain the world's, wrap your head around this, largest collection of art, right, with 9 miles of pieces, right, which could wrap four and a half times around the Vatican walls. You know, the Vatican is a country unto itself. It's a small country, so small that we had it carpeted, but it's a small country. Right? 9 miles worth of pieces. It has 1,400 rooms in it, chapels, galleries. The whole place is a museum, literally. They constitute the former wings of the Vatican Palace. In round figures, the Vatican Museum has 70,000 works of art in the collection. 20,000 of those works are on display at any given time, right? So just wrap, let's do some math. 1,440 minutes in a 24-hour period, 8 hours a day, 480 minutes, taking no breaks for food or the restroom. If you took 2 minutes to view every object that's on display, the 20,000, so 240 objects each day, it would take you 83.3 days to see just what is in that museum on display. If you wanted to see the entire collection using those parameters of 2 minutes to observe each of these amazing pieces of art, it would take you 291.6 days, right? For 8 hours a day, almost a year. 2 minutes of appreciation, no breaks. So we were fortunate enough, wife and I, to go there several years ago. We spent 6 hours there. 6 hours. And if you ever go, if you have the opportunity, I encourage you to, because it's amazing, get a guide, because it's kind of like the Winchester House. You're popping in and out of doors, and I'll never forget, and then boom, next thing you know, you're in the Sistine Chapel, and you're like, wow, Michelangelo, that guy, you know. And then boom, you're off, and you're running, and it is highly confusing. You know, obviously the grounds in the center are wide open, but the rest of it, it's a maze. We spent 6 hours. That's it. 6 hours, and probably a large amount of that time was in the Vatican gift store, because it's huge as well. It affirmed my love of Michelangelo. It confirmed to me that sometimes the collision between art and religion can get really strange, right? Walking down the halls, you begin to realize that in the center there, I don't know if you can see it very clearly, that the statues have one of these strategically placed on the statues, right? For those of you that are unaware, this was the result of what's known as the fig leaf campaign. The Catholic Church, in response to preaching of modesty during the Reformation, decided to cover up the naked figures featured in the statues. Pope Paul IV started it by mandating the fig leaves. Pope Innocent carried the policy forward. Pope Clement went on to campaign to cover all the statuary with the fig leaves. This work was followed by Pope Pius IX. What a great name, right? His name tells it all, right? Pope Pius IX, who didn't stop with the leaves, but actually damaged, desecrated, defiled many of the statues by taking a hammer to them and knocking off the bits in their individual privacy squares to completely have them removed, or, pun intended, smoothed over. The posture toward art did not manifest itself solely within the walls of the Vatican, right? There were plaster fig leaves created in England ready to cover these bits, and they made their way all the way to the United States. One of these was kept for Queen Victoria whenever she visited the Victoria and Albert Museum to view the works there. There was a statue of David, Michelangelo's David, and they had like this leaf ready where they would go and put it on. So when she walked by, she wouldn't be offended by it, and I don't, probably before Velcro, but then when she was gone, you know, they would restore the art back to its actual, and she wouldn't, you know, become complicated over it, right? So let's get back to the garden. At the very beginning, right, I suspect that the influences of the Reformation and our Puritan roots in this country may have a little something to do with the fact that not much attention has been paid to this, along with the fact that, again, we like to talk about the fall, because the fall sets the story for, you know, exile, and, you know, it patterns the children of Israel, right? Exile, and then God coming in, and then they blow it, and then they come back, and we get all the way up into Jesus coming, right? But we forget about this stuff in the garden, all right? What does the nakedness of Adam and Eve tell us? So here are a few suggestions, and I encourage you to think about this. This is just my musings. I haven't read this anywhere. It was just as I was pondering this. Maybe afterwards, the conversation, if you got some extra ideas, I'd love to incorporate them or explore that idea. Because I didn't Google naked because bad things happen. Naked in the garden. Those are things I just don't want to do, nor do I want that on my search history. Here are a few suggestions. The Garden of Eden, which a possible translation for the name actually is the Garden of Abundance, or the Provider of Abundance. So think about this. The fact that they are without clothes, that the garden was at a perfect temperature. Perfect. Has to be, right? I doubt it was snowing. I can't think of extreme heat either. Although there's always that adage, you can put on more clothes, but you can't take more off. They were safe, absolutely safe. I mean, that implies that by the fact that they're running around like they are. This was not an episode of Naked and Afraid, right? There was nothing present that was threatening or could cause them harm. Adam and Eve were not doing hard physical labor. Protective clothing is needed for this kind of endeavor. Adam and Eve completely lacked any such wardrobe or any clothes, as far as the story goes. And of course, in my mind, because I get bonus points for this, for incorporating a Monty Python reference, in the Holy Grail, if you remember, one of the lesser classes, Dennis, is working in the mud, and King Arthur rides up, and they have this whole conversation about systems of government. And then as he rides off, he says, the guy working with him says, "Who's that?" And he goes, "Must have been a king." He goes, "How do you know?" And he says, "Well, he doesn't have crap all over him," right? For you Python purists, that's not the word, but I wanted to keep it, you know, at least PG-13. Speaking of kings, Adam and Eve were not middle management, right? Genesis 1:26-28 says, "Then God said, 'Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, over the livestock, all the animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground.'" Adam and Eve held stewardship over the garden and its contents, working in concert with God. This couple were in a relationship, right, with the land and with each other. It is truly a prime example of shalom. They had no shame. They were not self-conscious. They were totally unencumbered, like a toddler, right? Running around the yard, Adam and Eve were happy, carefree, and totally without worry. Until a used car salesman of a snake, as the serpent is aptly described in Pete Enns and Jared Bea's book, Genesis for Normal People. I think the subtitle is one of the most abused books in the Bible, right? Which is a great read, by the way. He tells the couple, the snake, the serpent, to take the tree, take to the tree of knowledge and take it for a spin. Smell the interior, huh? Look at the display on the dash. Come on, it won't hurt you. Genesis 3, 6 through 7. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good and for the good and pleasing to the eye, and also described for gaining wisdom, she took some of it, ate it. She also gave some to her husband, who, underlined, was there with her. Right there. He wasn't like in the next room. He was right there. Go on. You know, you can imagine. Now I'm taking the text away, but I'm thinking. He's like, go ahead, Eve, go. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. All right, I'm not going to do it anatomically because I don't know how that's going to look on the video. But they made these, right? And then they hid in the bushes. Not very effective, right? Truly, think about that. That's really like a toddler, isn't it? You know, like when you play hide and when I play hide and go seek with my grandchildren, you know, this is what we get. Or they're just not like right on the other side of the door. With a couple of bites of fruit, according to the story, the fall happens and everything changes. The couple realizes that they're naked. They clothe themselves with leaves. They're exiled from the garden home, and they are faced with hardships and the reality of life. Wham! From knowing only a life of pure shalom to not understanding such goodness, to understanding evil, right? Let me say that again. Only understanding goodness, right? Because that's what they had in the garden. Pure happiness, right? They went from that to now bringing evil into the equation. That's a shift. And their first act with this understanding was to cover themselves up and to hide from God, which did not work. It didn't work then, and I can tell you right now, it doesn't work now for anybody in humanity. Hardships and the realities of life, humankind, has been doing that really effectively ever since. We have just added to our choices in the ensuing years when it comes to hiding from God. Which brings us today. So another little shift. I don't know if any of you saw this. The World Happiness Report from 24 came out just like, you know, a month and a half ago. It's the most comprehensive picture of happiness right across generations. A little side note. I was actually not going to include this, but since I read it, I'm going to share it with you anyway. When I retired a few years ago, I read a book called The Happiness Curve. Anybody familiar with this? That when you get past 50, you suddenly become more happy, according to studies. Out of Stanford and some other places, there's a whole section of Stanford study there that deals with as you age. That past 50, you get happier. For some reason, even though at that point, stuff's starting to break down, you know, just statistically. More and more, you wake up in the morning and go, oh, what was that? Where did that come from? And then you think you're dealing with that, and the next day it shifts. You're decaying, right? It's just the process of aging. And so, but there's this curve that happens. And pretty much I'll encapsulate the whole couple hundred page book with you that it has to do with time. And where you devote your time. They ask an 80-year-old guy about, friends. And he says, well, at 80, I'm not out there looking for my new best friend. Right? My new lifelong best friend. Right? I'm going to try to take care of what I've got here and now. when they construct some of these tests by age group, you know, people in their 30s, they're all over their map, all over the map. Kids, same thing. And then people in 50s, 60s, and beyond, they're focused on very specific use of their time. And then that's the paradox, right? That they're happier because they're focused. And the reason why they're focused is because there is less time in front of them than behind them. So that brings a clarity. I mean, it's like, whoa, okay, I get that, sure, as one now in that demographic. It's fascinating to me. Now, don't get this wrong. I as a word to the folks here that are in that age group, you know, between 20 and 50, we need you to be all over the place, right? We need you to be entrepreneurial. We need you to work hard and drive things forward, just like we did, right? And honestly, as a word to us in that age group, we are here to support you in that. It's a hard time of life, and that's why your happiness is lower than people that are older. Does that make sense? Am I making sense? Could somebody nod and just affirm me? Yeah, thank you. Okay, thank you. I found that fascinating. So anyway, back to this happiness survey. They use separate rankings by age for the first time. Children and those under 30, do you know, anybody know what they ranked as number one? Lithuania, as the happiest place on earth. Yeah, Lithuania, yeah, number one. For people older, right, 60 and older, you gotta know this one, because it's, like, I think, number one before they put an age survey into it. Denmark. Probably because both countries really take care of their populations. So, lo and behold, when you feel cared for, you feel more happy, right? We here in these United States, we're slipping. The United States is now 23rd, has fallen out of the top 20 for the first time since the survey was established in 2012, so over 10 years ago. Driven by a large drop in the well-being of Americans under 30. And the lowest on the rank is Afghanistan, which remains at the very bottom, ranked as the world's most unhappy nation, right? We have worries in the United States that account for our drop, right, in the current survey. We have inflation, cost of food, energy, day-to-day needs, the lack of affordable housing, debts on the rise, there are wars, unstable nations throwing their weight around. It's an election year with all the normal noise and nonsense and a heaving spoonful of what now thrown in. From the bottom of the list, right, Afghanistan, the reality of what that country is facing, is there any inhabitants of that nation that don't think nothing about what they have to worry about? What does it mean to have a flourishing relationship with self? That is a huge question, and there's no way, I don't have the capacity even to approach that. I'm going to try to take just a very small bite of it. There will be many answers over the next several weeks presented on this part of the series of the Restoration of Shalom. How do we learn to accurately see ourselves, love ourselves, accept ourselves, fully embracing our identities as the image bearers of Christ, for those of us that are Christ followers? How do we lay aside our false selves, right, this projection we have of ourselves, alongside with all the baggage that goes with that false image? As we pursue the answers to these questions and others over the coming weeks, I would like to start with just one aspect today. In a very concise and short way, I want to talk about worry. There are a few things in life that can slowly grind down and crush our happiness, like worry. Worry is insidious. It sneaks in. Sometimes it hits you like a hammer. To feel uneasy or concerned about something, to be troubled, to brood, to be concerned, perturbed, or stew, right? Worry in the horsey world, right? Those of you that have ridden horses, if you watch a horse, when they're chewing on their bit, right? It's kind of like messing with your fingernails. In people, you can detect worry by what they say. how they verbally express and react. It also comes out physically, their posture. Are they crushed down by the cares of the world? Another little thing just to let you in on for people as we age. Every time I go to the doctor, I'm getting shorter and shorter and shorter because the cares of the world are crushing me down, right? A troubled look in the eyes, often due to lack of sleep. How about the hands, right? Watch a person who's nervous and watch their hands. In self-defense class, they tell you, keep an eye on the hands, right? Because the hands, most of the time, are what can hurt you, right? If you're watching somebody's hands. But they can tell you a lot. They can tell you what may be coming. They can also telegraph worry. Worry can come upon us at any time. For some, it can feel the most powerful at night, right? When it comes in the middle of the night. Playing back events of things past, things done, things said. Why did I say that in the third grade? Bringing anxiety about failures, real and invented. Reckon our rest in what is most likely a false image of ourselves. Worry is often about the future, like the time spent between having a medical test and the results finally coming in. If anybody's ever had a biopsy, right? And usually, even if it's like something horrendous, once you get that diagnosis, like you actually get the confirmation, and now there's a plan to deal with it, any of you that have experienced this, suddenly, I'm told, that worry goes down. Because it's, at least now, okay, I know what I'm dealing with. But it's that time between the test, and in some cases, like weeks, for you to find out. And that whole time, you know, of course you do the worst thing ever. You go on, you know, WebMD and all roads lead to destruction, right? The uncertainty of it, our lack of ability to control it, devolving into what we would do if our worst fears come to pass. Sometimes worry comes in real time. What if I fail right now as I attempt this? What should I say? What should I do, right? These are the questions that come to all of us. These are the questions that I asked myself when I started this teaching. Right here, right now, in real time. How's that for meta? I have worried about this teaching on worry. As one who has attempted to be a Christ follower for my whole life, I could only come up with one place to go. The rabbi Jesus, the one sometimes called the second Adam, spoke about worry. His teaching on the subject is featured in the Gospels of both Luke and Matthew. Scholars contend that this teaching was one that was most likely repeated more than is recorded in the biblical text. It was a go-to for Jesus. Why? Because it's a go-to for us as human beings. They just weren't recorded, but they are in the two different Gospels. Today, we'll take a look at Luke's Gospel, chapters 12, 22 through 34. We find Jesus with his disciples surrounded by a crowd, right? He warns those listening about hypocrisy, that ultimately all will be exposed. People live out what they believe, right? He speaks about the Holy Spirit. He turns his attention to the false security of relying on possessions and wealth. He deals with an issue of inheritance. He deals with a rich man. He then turns his attention to his closest followers and speaks to them plainly and directly. So think about this setting, right? Jesus is in this large crowd, and he teaches, you know, in metaphor and in parable, and he's dealing with people asking him questions. And then after he's done with that, he gathers his disciples in close. And now he's just going to speak plainly and directly to them. And here we sit in here and now, and we hear these words speaking directly to us as well. He says, holy smokes. Excuse me. Thank you. Slide 7. If I just had looked behind me, Brian, thank you. Luke 22 through 34. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear, for life is more than food, and the body is more than clothes." Right? It's the pyramid. Was it Maslow, right? Maslow hierarchy of needs. These are at the bottom. But he's speaking so much bigger than that. Do not worry about your life. The word for life here, translated from the Greek, means my soul. I, myself, the inner internal part of a person, the essence of who you are. Life, yourself, your soul, right? When Jesus talks about worry, it does not include planning, right? Or simply considering, I said right, I want to show you something. I'm trying my best. I had a thing. It says right with a slash through it. And my wife said, you should have everybody clap when you say right. But I don't want to do that, one, because it would just get obnoxious. And second off, if I did that and you didn't clap, I think they're not listening. But, you know, when you teach, you get these ticks. Right. I'm trying to avoid it. I'm sorry. Just want to put it out that. I'm not going to worry about that anymore. Right? Thanks, Mike. When Jesus talks of worry, does not include planning or simply considering our best options before us. He's speaking directly to the kind of worry that can lead to anxiety. Right? Dang it. Own it. Thank you. Preach. Being consumed by the problem often leading to all kinds of issues. Today, we know that the top issues about anxiety and being consumed are mental and physical health. I mean, those are broad categories, but that's where it comes in. If you're consumed by anxiety, not by simple planning, he clearly states that who you are, yourself, is far more important than the basics of life, food, and clothing. It's part of a reoccurring theme. Life is more. That more, that happiness, comes not what we do or what we eat or what we wear. It comes from giving our life to God. Jesus then uses nature as an example. Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn. By the way, this little callback to the verses prior to this engagement with the disciples about the foolish rich man and his hoarding ways, right? And you got to wonder, he was probably still there kind of leaning in and listening, and he's like, he's talking about me, right? Right? Yet God feeds them, and how much more valuable are you than the birds? Hey, he's talking about me, said the rich young fool. Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to your life? Since you cannot do this very little thing, why do you worry about the rest? Verse 25 is just great. It's like, it's hyperbole, right? It's translated another way. The text asks, can you add a cubit to your height? So a cubit, I'm sure a lot of you know what this is. It's the measurement between like the elbow and tip of your finger. All the different commentaries I read put it between like 17 inches and like 27 inches. So think about that. If you could add 27 inches to your height, I'm sure you're sitting there thinking, wow, I never thought I could play professional basketball, right? That is a mind-boggling thought, to be that tall. Never really considered it, playing in the NBA. No matter how you read this text, a year to your life or 2+ feet to your height is absolutely ridiculous, laughable. Jesus is using a form of comedy to poke at worry, which, by the way, is a great way of dealing with worry, is to just laugh at it, if you can muster that. How ridiculously unreasonable worry truly is what Jesus is pointing out. The young rabbi then asked them to look at the wildflowers. Just look at them. This isn't Darwin studying, right? He's just saying, have a look, right? You don't have to spend hours just looking at the plant. Consider how the wildflowers grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. These plants don't work. They don't create. They don't make anything. They just are. And as they are simply just beautiful. And that remark about Solomon to a Jewish audience that surrounded him, including his closest disciples, that was a comparison. Because Solomon was the wisest. And when you look at images of Solomon, wow, he was, you know, handsome man, splendor in terms of his dress, because he was a king. It's good to be king, they say, right? It meant something. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and gone tomorrow, and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? Said another way, don't worry. If this is how God treats the flowers and the grass, that measure their existence in hours and then are gone, how do you think God's going to treat you? How do you not set your heart on what you will eat? And do not set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about it. For the pagan world, and you can take out that word pagan, just say the world, runs after such things. Your Father knows that you need them. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be given to you. Do not be afraid, little flock. And that's an enduring term, little flock. For your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Jesus ends this discussion about worry with this last point about possessions, right? By challenging the disciples and us sitting here now in a country filled with consumption, our economy is driven by consumers. He ends this whole discussion about possessions. If you faithfully follow, God is pleased to give you so much more than these possessions, the kingdom itself. And then he says, sell your possessions, give to the poor, provide purses for yourself that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will never fail, where no thief comes and no moth will destroy. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He's speaking in grand terms here. This isn't an order for all of us to sell everything. That's not a reasonable request. Jesus is making a point. Maybe not as strong as adding a cubit to your height, but nonetheless the same thing. That what we have is so transitory, it just doesn't matter. As you age, going back to the aging thing, you start doing this cleanse with all of the junk because you realize, I don't want my kids to have to throw this stuff out. I don't want them looking through my boxes going, why did Dad hold on to this, right? You start realizing that all of the stuff, and I like my stuff. I really do. I like my stuff. And it's been an exercise in learning to push it out the door, which comes with its own joy, to be sure. If restoration of shalom is what we are truly after, that true peace, that all-encompassing peace with God and nature and each other and ourselves, for us, ourselves, that peace cannot come without pushing back and eliminating as much as we can worry. It means living right here and right now. That's an easy phrase to like fold into yourselves, the idea of saying, I'm right here, right now. I'm not thinking about the past because there's not much. I can atone for my past. I can tell people I'm sorry for things I've said, but what I've said, I've already said. What I've already done, I've already done. I'm not changing that. I'm not Doctor Who. Can't get in a phone booth. Go back and change it. It's not going to happen. Right here, right now, in this moment, and all the moments that follow. The past is the past. We must accept that we can plan for the future, but we can't control it either. Jesus put it emphatically in Luke's gospel and in the gospel of Matthew. do not worry about your life. Simply put, right? But not simply lived. Simply put, but not simply lived. Worry comes in so many forms and so many strengths for so many people with different places in their lives and different personalities. It's complex. And there's not an easy answer for this, but I will. I feel remiss today as I'm wrapping this thing up to say to you that if you are struggling with worry, talk to somebody, right? I mean, I think prayer is, you know, number one, but talk to a fellow human. That's what this place is about. Talk to someone who's close to you, a friend, a loved one, a family member. Talk to a professional. If it's getting the best of you, seek men and women, people that have studied and understand how crushing this can be and can provide you ways of dealing with it. And there are those in the world out there that'll say, don't do that. You know, that's not wrong. It's making use of the intelligence that God has permeated our society with. Why would you? Anyway, I don't get that. If you find yourself overwhelmed, please do not hesitate to seek help. I'd like to move on from this topic for today. I'm just going to leave it there and challenge us as a congregation and as individuals as we talk about this issue of self to constantly think about when worry creeps in, trying to deal with it and not let it get the better of us. So I'd like to move on from this topic today and close with a couple of quotes about love, because I think love is the cure-all. And to consider as we transition into worship. As I read, I'm going to ask Chris and Ginny to come up for our time together. So the first quote, it's a simple one from a man who I love. I love his writing. He was a hard person. Talk about a person that dealt with all kinds of things. That's Brennan Manning, and he said this: "I'm wondering just how dangerous it is to choose not to love the life we're given." Next quote: "We may find that we punish ourselves mercilessly for real or imagined sins, and even then, you know, real and imagined, that's where worry comes in, right? We will not forgive ourselves. Fortunately, Christ has revealed the real God to us in unmistakably human form, exposed projection for the idolatry that it is, and given us the way to become free from it. It takes a profound conversion to accept the belief that God is tender and loves us just as we are, not in spite of our sins and faults, but with them. God does not condone or sanction evil, but he does not withhold his love because there is evil in us. The key to understanding is the way we feel about ourselves. We cannot even stand or accept love from another human being when we do not love ourselves, much less believe or accept that God could possibly love us." That's from Father Bernard Bush, Society of Jesus. You join me in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you. I thank you for your words. We thank you for story and how the story exposes within us our each individual stories and tales. Father, we thank you for the words of Jesus. We ask your blessing upon this time of worship, and we give it to you. Amen.